This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 12th of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 57th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. This week we're rag, bag and tag-tailing our way around a number of fascinating things, and these are some of those things. I went to Siberia to find some snow, read some Russian books and meet the woman that's attempting to reinvigorate one Siberian city with art and literature.
I'm very happy that the British writers managed to come to Krasnoyarsk. I hope that's the beginning of a new, wonderful long-term tradition.
We'll be getting angular of haircut, spiky of attitude and indie of outlook with the Midori House session from Canadian sisters Tegan and Sarah.
We're taking these tours with bands that we really admire and love, and it's allowing us to get into bigger venues and working in situations with higher production value and getting to play in front of a completely new audience, which is super exciting for us.
And we'll take a trip down to the New Zealand Audio Foundation to hear what sonic gems they've been storing up in their basement. We're talking bird noises, jam jars, oral traditions.
It requires listening in a deep sense, and it requires a different framework of mind for it, an artistic framework of mind. It's like any form of contemporary art, I think.
Plus, we'll reflect on 10 years of the Copenhagen Documentary Film Festival and hear how the Contemporary Art Society is spreading an impressive collection around the UK's galleries. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. First up, the Canadian songstresses and sisters who bring a side order of stand-up to their shows. Tegan and Sarah are currently on tour around the UK and soon to be the US with The Killers. They stopped by at Midori House recently between their London shows to play a storming session for our Music Hungry gang. Here's the first track from that session, Back in Your Head.
Build a wall of books between us in our bed. Repeat the words that I know we both said. Relax into the knee, we get so comfortable. Remember when I was so stranger like a bull? Jerk away from holding hands with you. Well, I know these habits hurt important parts of you. Remember when I was sweet and unexplainable. I'm nothing like this person, unlovable. I just want back in your head.
That was Tegan and Sarah with Back in Your Head, and we'll hear a little bit more from them later on in the show. And now, a missive from Russia. I went to Siberia to find a good book, or a good chat about some books, or to find someone who really loves the city of Krasnoyarsk in southern Siberia. Don't think that southern means not cold, though. South means nothing in those there parts near the Mongolian border. So who is this someone who really wants to change the face of this Soviet-looking place with the power of words? Irina Prokhorova is the sister of Russia's third richest man, Mikhail Prokhorov, and famously debated on his behalf during the elections on Russian TV earlier this year, for which she was lionized in the least likely parts. Prokhorova also founded the New Literary Observer, a magazine and a publishing house. The Krasnoyarsk Book Fair was her baby 2 weeks ago, and one of the guests of honour was the British novelist and critic Alex Preston. So before we hear from Irina Prokhorova, Alex joins us to put the Russian literary scene in focus, despite the vodka.
I'd only ever been to Moscow before, and it was, you know, this extraordinary experience for me to be in Moscow. And it was great to have a stop off in Moscow on the way. And we had an event where you and I got on the stage and talked about a hero of our time, using the Lermontov novel as a way into thinking about how do we define heroism now. And then it seemed, in a kind of heroic step ourselves, we launched ourselves on the Aeroflot.
We had to buy a hat first.
You got a fine hat. I bought my hat in Siberia. I think it's not as fine a hat as yours. But so we were with a couple of English writers, Teresa Breslin, Melvin Burgess, and Tibor Fischer, who this was all part of the Edinburgh World Writers Festival, which they were celebrating 50 years since that great 1962 festival, where they had the conference with luminaries from Norman Mailer to Lawrence Durrell to Muriel Spark, talking about the place of literature, the place of the novel, what the novel should do. And to reprise this 50 years on, they sent writers to these outposts around the world, and we kind of piggybacked on the back of that. But when we got there, you know, I found this extraordinary enthusiasm for literature, an extraordinary interest in the place of the novel, in where the novel is going. The first day, Melvin Burgess gave a speech about should the novel be political, and the thing that kind of amused and entertained me the most was the difference between the British and the Russian authors. I mean, you tend to go to literary festivals, I went to a literary festival in Antwerp the other day, and you just feel that actually there isn't all that much between you and the local Belgian author in terms of your political views, in terms of sort of what you think about the place of literature, et cetera, et cetera. What was kind of bracing about this conference out there was just how different, because of such different cultures, because of, you know, a kind of hermeticism of the Russian system for so long, they just speak different languages. And it was brilliant to watch the kind of baffled faces of either side as they listened to what seemed to them totally ridiculous statements. Melvin saying, you know, all literature is necessarily political, which is something with which I think I agree. And his counterpart, who I think was, who's a philologist called Andrei Atsaturov, I think was his name, just looking as if he'd just said the most controversial thing, and then making a long and impassioned speech about how politics had been replaced by corporatism. And it did seem in the end that a lot of it was kind of arguing about terms, which is never...
I suppose when you have an argument with a philologist, that's going to end up coming into it.
Exactly.
You're going to end up getting frantic about your semantics. Mm. But that kind of goes back to the idea that people are unashamed to be serious, to use terms of criticism in everyday conversation about books, which I think perhaps, maybe you can tell me, doesn't seem to be part of the British European, maybe the American discourse.
No,
maybe the Anglo-American discourse is always kind of trying to argue that books are entertainment too.
Yes, and actually, my previous trip to Moscow, I gave the plenary address at the International Tolstoy Conference at Tolstoy's home in Yasnaya Polyana, and I put in a few gags. And never, I mean, it went down like a Pussy Riot gig in the Kremlin. It was just totally the wrong vibe. Which, you know, I mean, I learnt that one should never, ever joke about literature with Russians.
It's horses for courses, and these are dressage horses.
Yes, exactly.
Cool. Well, we'll go and hear now my interview with Irina Prokhorova. For the time being, Alex Preston, as ever, thank you very much for coming in and talking hats and literature.
would say the mission of the foundation, that's Michael Prokhorov Fund, is to support cultural initiatives in the Russian regions. And so when it was launched in 2004, that's what the main strategy was worked out. And I think it's very important, not only because Russian regions survive this is a very hard time for culture in a way, because there are no resources and quite a lot of brilliant young people just leave the regions, go into Moscow or abroad. So of course our mission, to create an atmosphere, a situation where people can stay and realize their dreams and their creativity. But I would say, I think this is the problem, not only for Russia, but for many other countries, where regional local culture is always underestimated and considered a bit provincial, So the idea of the foundation to create cultural centers, a variety of cultural centers across the country, which I think the most important thing if we want to develop the country, to make it really civilized and prosperous land in a way. So we're doing our best.
And the idea of sort of culture as being an important, something that can teach you morality, something that is important to sort of civil society, that seems to be something that that you're interested in and very much believe in. Is that one of the aims of the festival and of the other things you do, the magazine and the publishing house?
First of all, in Russia, traditionally, culture played a very big role in other spheres of life. And so I think it's the stem of Russian identity in many ways. Besides them, in contemporary world, I would say cultural industries, I would say they're the leading tools of developing regions. And we know quite a lot of examples, I would say, in the UK and other countries, when these stagnating cities were developed through cultural initiatives, through all the cultural hubs, and industries. So we're trying to apply these new ideas about culture as economic vehicle for development, and try to apply it to Krasnoyarsk and other regions.
Because I guess there's a shortage of libraries, of art museums and things. There's an amazing museum here, the Lenin Museum. That's an interesting sort of an idea. And there's a huge amount of kind of, it seems that if people have one building to play with, it seems that the ideas are very unfettered. It seems like there's a proper engagement with history, with culture, with context. There's a lot of very lively people doing things in this city.
Yes, I would say that Krasnoyarsk being an industrial and a cultural center in many ways, educational center, there are quite a lot of universities there. So, of course, there are quite a lot of activity, creativity going on. The only problem is just to find support, not only money, but in a way, special attention. The problem is that during the Soviet period, no one was taught how to deal with initiatives. No one knew about management, practical side. Or it's a problem giving you information what's going on in the world, and what are contemporary ways of developing culture, what different genres appears. So we try to combine this, I would say, charity and education in many ways. And as far as this Museum for Contemporary Art is concerned, so it started in the early 90s on the basis of the former Lenin Museum. And I think that's unique combination. There are quite a lot of talks about history in Russia, how we can deal with a tragic past. So I think this example of this museum, I would say wonderful, because in a way they didn't ruin anything. So they left this exposition of Lenin, untouched, but somehow they recoded it and put it into the postmodern context. So this is overcoming of history, reforming history in many ways, not forgetting it, but somehow transforming. Yeah. And I think that could be kind of metaphor, what we're trying to do from the point of our cultural initiatives. The main problem in Russia, really, is the problem of forgetting the past. I understand it emotionally because it's so tragic and so traumatic, so the first impulse just not to think about it, or trying to glamorize it, saying that it was a wonderful empire, and everyone was afraid of us in a way. The hardest way, and is just to deal with the past decently, to say frankly that was awful time in a way, but we can't get rid of it. So I think the example of this museum, that is keep this memory, but on the other hand, you give the new image of the country, because this is the really Museum for Contemporary Art. Quite a lot of provocative and interesting exhibitions going on. So nowadays, this Lenin exhibition, can be viewed as a kind of provocative art in a way. But on the other hand, it's quite original, it's authentic. So probably we should think twice about how can we deal with this past.
Why Krasnoyarsk? I know, obviously, you have a big affection for the city in this part of the world, but it's not where you're from, is it? How did Krasnoyarsk come about to you and the foundation?
Yes, I'm Moscovite. I was born in Moscow. I would say it happened so that we spoke with my brother for several years. It was his idea to launch a charity foundation. It was very difficult to find proper strategy because you can waste money and won't achieve anything. But when in 2003 my brother became the general director of Norilsk Nickel, this is a huge enterprise on the north of Siberia in Norilsk. This is the Arctic zone in a way. And when he first got acquainted with the awful conditions in which people are living, so then this idea of the foundation supporting local culture appeared. And so that this Krasnoyarsk region became our, I would say, basis for our activity, and still is. This is our major region. Of course, now we're just spreading our activities to other territories. But the idea is to work systematically and for many years in one region, so raising this so-called creative class, so to say, the critical amount of people, who can change and transform cultural and economic life. So that is a very difficult task. It's much easier, to have a number of very effective, glamorous events, having quite a lot of publicity anyhow. But our major idea is to work silently and, systematically, and realizing that probably we will see results in 20, 30 years. But I think this is the only way to create something real, serious, and I would say that would survive, in years. This is investment in future.
Finally, I wanted to ask you about, obviously at the festival you've had British writers coming to talk and do workshops and things, and there's that idea of exporting of culture, or people visiting and telling you their expertise and all the rest of it. Is a sign of the strength of Russian culture when more of it, whether it's pop music or literature, is exported? Is that very important? And is that part of the foundation? Is that part of your plan?
Yes, of course. If we want to develop a region, of course, what is meant to develop? It's not only bringing something, exporting, but it's importing as well. I would say, I wouldn't use these words. It looks like, trading in a way, but I would say this is exchange of ideas and people, innovations. That's the most important thing. Otherwise, any culture will become provincial, which is self-isolated. So this is the second part of foundation, that's bringing the regions to the world and the world to the regions. So we try to support as much connection as we can. And by the way, nowadays, we have a number of activities dealing with exchange with the British universities. So I would say that University in Sheffield is inviting a number of Russian scholars who could, lecture, who could work in the library, and we support that in a way. We have a very good connection with the Vienna Sociological Institute, so there is also a grant for Russian scholars to come there. And just lately we announced a three-year program with the Brooklyn Academy of Music, so that will be cultural exchange, and the program is called Transcultural Express. Yes, so that will be, exchange of artists, writers, musicians, all kinds of creative people between the two countries. So I'm very happy that the British writers managed to come to Krasnoyarsk. I hope that's the beginning of a new, wonderful, long-term tradition.
That was Irina Prokhorova talking with me in Siberia a couple of chilly weeks ago. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. CPH Docs Copenhagen's International Documentary Film Festival, is considered one of the finest on the planet. It's just wrapped up its 10th edition, a convenient milestone to look back over a decade in which documentaries have moved into the multiplexes and reflect on why the Danish documentary scene is leading the world. While the event was still underway, we dispatched our Copenhagen correspondent Michael Booth to meet up with the festival's founder and director, Tina Fischer, to discuss some of these points and hear about the highlights from this year's festival.
I was asked if I wanted to start a documentary festival in Copenhagen, and I have to say that I hesitated because I thought, am I really going to spend my life doing a festival with an audience who are not really willing to see documentary films? So I considered it overnight and I said, let's try and do a pilot version of it, and if it works, then let's go on. And this is just seen from our perspective. What we did was we said, okay, each film has an audience. We just need to find them and we need to convince them that it's fun to watch documentaries. So we hooked up with external partners on the music scene, in contemporary art, political activist parties, etc. And in that sense, we filled up the cinemas during these first 5 days.
By identifying those special interest groups, targeting them and knowing how to draw them in.
Yes. In a sense, we started doing outreach before and doing social media before Facebook. And that worked, and it was a small festival and with no marketing budget. And it grew really, really, really quickly in that working that way. But seen from a larger international perspective, we also started the festival alongside Michael Moore's two big budget, large-scale documentaries. 9/11.
He was really the guy that kickstarted, brought documentaries into the mainstream. Like multiplex goers would go and see a documentary after Michael Moore, right?
Yes. I mean, he made two films that, first of all, went into multiplex, was released by major studios, and went to Cannes and won. The first time a documentary won the Golden Palm. So, I mean, in that sense, he really kicked it off. And it also meant that I think the industry, not only in Denmark, but also in the rest of Europe, suddenly saw, okay, you can actually make money on producing and distributing documentary films. And in Denmark, it meant that there was a huge film about a Danish band called Gasoline that suddenly hit the cinemas and had huge, huge, huge audience.
Yeah, det var det, ikke? Vi har holdt sammen i 3 år, og så sker der altid automatisk noget. Drift og omkostninger, halløjse.
I was going to say there's been some discussion in the Danish media I know about, well, what exactly is a documentary now, because the remit, it seems so broad with the films you've included this year, over 200 films, is that right? Where do you draw the line between fiction and fact?
What I say is that I don't draw a line. I think it does make sense to put up, let's say, definitions like direct cinema did. You cannot or you should not. So what I say is that I think documentary films has a certain relationship to reality that fiction does not necessarily need to have. And by that, I say you can, formally speaking or in terms of how you choose to tell your story, which genre you use, you can do anything, just as fiction. But you have a certain relationship to reality, which means that you are somehow you're in dialogue with real people and something that happens or has happened. And that is a part of your ethical, let's say, divining your methodology from an ethical perspective.
So obviously, drama docs, no problem there, welcome.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and you also see, I mean, this year we have quite a number of, I think it's a strong tendency right now, we have quite a number of reenacted films, and reenactment is almost like a bit old-fashioned, or like you call it drama documentaries, but the new way of reenacting is really different. So it's also reinventing those tools that has been somehow almost lost within a documentary context.
Can you give us an idea of the scale of the festival today compared to 10 years ago? How many films did it start off with? How many people came 10 years ago, and how many today?
Yeah, so the festival as a public event was, I think the first year we screened around 55 films, and there was 12,000 people coming in, which was much more than we expected. And this year we're screening 205 films, and I guess we will have around 50,000, or last year we had 48, so something like that.
Can you maybe talk about some highlights? What films are you especially looking forward to? We're a few days into the festival now, but what's to come that you're looking forward to?
There's a film called The Act of Killing, which is by an American filmmaker called Joshua Oppenheimer. It's produced from a Danish production company.
Saya pemenang. Saya mesti bikin juga definisi kejahatan perang.
Kita butuh preman yang melaksanakan jalan Pancasila.
Bayangin di gelap gulita ini.
It premiered in Toronto, and it has its European premiere here, and it's already, I mean, it's already creating huge fuss, huge debate, and it, of course, because it's a very radical film. Before the release in Toronto, it was supported by Werner Herzog and Errol Morris, so they stand up as executive producers now, which also means, of course, it comes into the circuit with a lot of support already. But I would say that speaking about how the genre has moved towards fiction, but also, let's say, discovering new territories in terms of how you actually do make documentary, it's a prime example, because it's a story from Indonesia from the 60s, and they reenact these massacres that took place with the real people.
And in terms of Danish documentary, how healthy is the field here in Denmark?
I think, now I'm Danish, but I'm not really on a mission in that sense. And I believe that I'm not the only one who says that the Danish documentary field or scene is one of the strongest in the world right now. And it's not only because of talented filmmakers, but it's also because there is a support system, the Danish Film Institute, which is highly supportive of, not only supportive in terms of financial support, but also supportive of actually developing a new scene, developing new talents, taking huge risk in terms of what would happen if it was only broadcast financed. And there's a film school that has happened parallel to the festival growing up. There's a film school which has a proper documentary film department, which means that there are filmmakers who are next to fiction filmmakers educated in cinema. And I think that you can really see that the production value of the films are really high.
That was CPH Docs founder and director Tina Fisher talking to Michael Booth in Copenhagen. And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. You're tuned into Monocle 24, and we're back after this to hear about how London's Contemporary Art Society is bringing a private collection to the masses.
As more and more governments demand cuts in public spending, design in healthcare is viewed more often than not as an unaffordable luxury. But design-savvy Denmark, not surprisingly, recognises the curative potential of good design.
If you should look at the outcome for the patients, you should really think about the design, about the inclusion of nature, about the inclusion of organic materials, because it really lifts the patients.
Monocle Films drops in on a hospice that feels more like a home. Broadcasting now on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. A bit of art now, reclaimed for the nation, as it were. What happens when you have a big collection of sculptures and paintings and you're not the profit-minded collecting type, but the old-school acquisitive with an eye on bequeathing to the nation? British collectors Eric and Jean Cass's collection of 300 amazing pieces, much of it post-war British art, is being divided up between 8 British museums by the Contemporary Art Society, a thing with an august history itself. Lucy Bailey, head of gifts at the CAS, shed some light on this art windfall.
The Contemporary Art Society, to sort of go back a bit, it's a charity that's been going for 100 years, mm-hmm. and it was set up with the Bloomsbury set. So sort of glamorous people in 1910, like Lady Ottilie Morell and...
Yeah.
Roger Fry, people that ran Tate and Whitechapel, and they all got together and they thought that work by Picasso and Gauguin weren't being purchased for museums like Tate. So they thought, we'll get together, we'll raise some money and we'll buy those works and we'll gift them to museums.
And this is a thing, this is kind of like a leitmotif of museum buying or museum acquisition, that they always kind of seem to be a little bit behind the times. I guess you'll see they can't be gunning with the art market, especially these days. But it comes from that kind of noble, quite a noble kind of tradition, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. A lot of works in museums have come from gifts or bequests. And museums would want to be more ahead of the curve than they can be just because of funds. But the kind of core of a lot of museum collections have come from private donors. And the CAS has been really fundamental in enabling that to happen.
We're talking today primarily because Eric and Jean Cass have gifted 300 mm-hmm. new works, or modern and contemporary works, to the Contemporary Art Society to be spread out across the country, the UK, across eight museums.
Yeah, that's right.
So this is a big deal. This is the sort of breaking news to the Contemporary mm-hmm. Art Society. You must feel bountiful and buoyant with this.
Yeah, it's such a wonderful thing, because they really are some of the most generous people I've ever met. They've spent over 30 years supporting artists, buying their work. And it's not just an artist who might have an established career. They've bought works because they really love them. And they've just fallen in love with the object. And they've brought it into their home that they call Bleep. And so their home is...
The house is called Bleep.
Yeah, it's called Bleep.
As in what? As in bleep?
It's got a sort of personality of its own. Eric built it himself.
Where's it? And their house is in Surrey. It's in the south of England.
Yeah, in Virginia Water. It's a modernist building. It's got a sort of Scandinavian feel to it. And it was built with Eric and an architect in the 1960s to house their collection of works. And they called it Bleep because Eric had an electronics business and the bleeping paging devices that they use in hospitals. It's sort of named after that.
Can you tell us some of your personal highlights or some of maybe CAS's highlights from the Cass collection?
Overall, it's got a sort of joyous feel. Everything's really light-hearted, reflecting them as a couple. It's quite sort of sexy work, all sort of modernist, as you say, modernist sculpture. The highlight is probably the Barbara Hepworth sculpture called Totem. It has a sort of nice story because they had a call from a woman called Lindy Kosh, who ran a gallery in Cork Street that doesn't exist anymore, but it was a gallery called Quinton Green Fine Art. And she'd heard about this private collection that was being distributed because the company had closed. And she'd heard about this sculpture. And it's a sort of a classic Barbara Hepworth marble sculpture. It's about 6 foot tall and really beautiful. You can look at it from different angles and the forms within, the sort of holes inside, you can see it in different perspectives. They came across this collection in storage and had to climb across rubble. And then climbed across rubble and found this amazing piece. So it was a real sort of...
That's a proper find.
Yeah,
it's the definition of a find.
Yeah. I think out of all of the works, that was the real discovery. Yeah, and the highlight of the gift. And it's gone to the Hepworth Wakefield in Yorkshire.
And what about Eric and Jean themselves as collectors? Yeah. They've obviously, as you say, they've obviously built up their collection over their lifetime together. What are they like?
Incredibly wonderful hosts, very friendly. Yeah. They laugh a lot. Eric laughs all the time and... Jean sort of tells these amazing little anecdotes. Eric is from Berlin, born in 1922. He's from an incredible family called the Cassere family. One of his relatives was Ernst Cassere, the famous philosopher. Mm-hmm. Another relative was Paul Cassere, who set up a major art gallery in Berlin that brought post-impressionism to Germany. So he's from this real kind of art family. And he came over in 1933 when his family left Germany and settled in Surrey. And he was in electronics and set up this business and met Jean in the 1960s when she was his secretary.
And there's a lovely work, isn't there, in the collection called Secretary. And I can't remember who the artist is now.
It's Alan Jones.
Sort of swinging through the book here. Yeah. And this is quite a sexy, work, isn't it, of kind of almost rubberized stitched up stockings and high-heeled shoes.
Yeah, that emerge out of the wall.
Yeah.
And Eric had that in his study. So the first work that you see when you come in are these two sexy legs that come out of the wall.
I think every office needs this.
Yeah.
Right? And where's that going to end up?
Amazingly though, they're based on, apparently they're based on Alan Jones's wife's legs.
Right.
Because he's quite a controversial artist that a lot of feminists have got very angry with.
A leg connoisseur. He's a leg man, we can safely say.
Definitely is a leg man, yeah.
And I wondered with this in mind, you know, you're obviously knowledgeable about the Cass collection and what's going where and all the rest of it. Mm. How much of your job is curatorial and how much of it is sort of wrangling? Because it's a tough thing, isn't it? You have to have a great appreciation for things and it's very sociable and it's lovely and you get to go to places and see these wonderful pieces. And you sort of have to tighten the screw a bit as well, don't you?
Yeah. I think it's sort of... we draw a lot on the incredible knowledge of curators in museums. And some of them have worked in museums for 20, 30 years and they are extremely knowledgeable about their collection and about art history. So for this gift... we selected a group of museums and they came to the house and spoke to Eric and Jean. They researched thoroughly all the works they thought would have relevance for their collection. And then they proposed a cluster of works that would improve or develop their collections in new and different ways. So CAS, Contemporary Art Society, sits in this position across private collecting and public collecting. And we sort of enable the two sides to meet. So... I think more, it's rather than we have a curatorial stance and a perspective, but we draw on the knowledge that is existing in museums because I think they know their collections and they know
that's kind
what
of their
works.
Job and yours are slightly separate.
Yeah.
And finally, where did the Casses collect from? I mean, they have great relationships with galleries, they have great relationships with artists. that went sort of behind the front window of the gallery. I mean, did they buy from auction? Where did the most of their gear
all over,
come from?
Everything you've mentioned, from the artist directly, from so they go on cruise ship holidays about 3 or 4 times a year, and they bought, so
I'm not think I'm making a face, and so are you. We should say this doesn't normally think this is a great way to buy art or meet great art.
But majority isn't from the holidays, but occasional pieces are, which makes it really interesting.
Yeah,
it's not just like this simple, perfectly modernist formed collection. It's eclectic, and it reflects all of their experiences and all of their trips and travels around the world. So when they've bought Nikita Samphal works, it might have been in Gympie Fees in London, but it might also have been visiting her studio on one of their cruise ship holidays. They visited established artists as well as artists that are completely unknown.
That was Lucy Bailey from the Contemporary Art Society talking to me here at our little art society, a.k.a. Midori House. Still to come in part two, we'll catch up with the charming twins Tegan and Sarah and hear some more from their lovely little Midori House session. And we'll hop over to New Zealand to hear what the nation's Audio Foundation have got up their sleeve. So first, let's hear some more from this week's session from Tegan and Sarah. They came, they sang, they entertained. After their session, they caught up with Muso and session booker extraordinaire Monocle's Tom Hall. But first, this is Tegan and Sarah with I'm Not Your Hero from their latest EP, In Your Head.
Standing where I am now, standing up at all. I was used to feeling like I was never gonna see myself at the finish line. Hanging on to parts of me, hanging on at all. I was used to seeing no future in my sight line. Sometimes it feels like they wanna remind me, send all those villains after me. I'm not the hero, but that doesn't mean that I wasn't brave. I never walked the party line, doesn't mean that I was never afraid. I'm not your hero, but that doesn't mean we're not one in the same. Feeling like I am now, lighting up the hall. I was used to standing in the shadow of a damaged heart, learning all I know now, losing all I did. I never used to feel like I'd be standing so far ahead. Sometimes it feels what I recovered you lost, sending your peaceful loss to me. I'm not the hero, but that doesn't mean that I wasn't brave. I never walked the party line, doesn't mean that I was never afraid. I'm not your hero, but that doesn't mean sometimes it feels like the side that I'm on plays the toughest hand, holds the longest stare. Sometimes it feels like I'm all that they've got, so hard to know I'm not what they want. But sometimes it feels like the side that I'm on plays the toughest hand, holds the longest stare. Sometimes it feels like I'm all that they've got. It's so hard to know I'm not what they want. I'm not the hero, but that doesn't mean that I wasn't brave. I never walked the party line, doesn't mean that I was never afraid. I'm not sure.
your hero, but that doesn't mean we're not one in the same. Do my best to walk the finest line till I've had all that I can say.
You join us here on Monocle 24, and we're very lucky to be joined by Tegan and Sarah. How are you doing?
We're good.
Yeah.
Yep, doing very well. I'm a little congested, so I'll try not to.
Yeah, Tegan's kind of sick. Yeah. I'm at full force.
You're playing some pretty huge shows over here with bands like The Killers, and you've been playing with Black Keys in the US.
Yeah.
I mean, is that a step up in venue? Is that something that you're accustomed to? Or, I mean, are you always playing to those massive crowds?
I mean, when we're generally headlining, obviously we're doing sort of much smaller rooms. And the last couple of albums we put out, like over the last like 5 years or so, we really focused on cultivating our own headlining show and audience. And right now it's sort of more of a strategic and kind of, I don't know, I guess like working out. Like we're taking these tours with bands that we really admire and love, and it's allowing us to get into bigger venues and working in situations with higher production value and getting to play in front of a completely new audience, which is super exciting for us. And it sort of is a way that we can, you know, promote the band and sort of get back at it. But also, you know, sometimes doing your own shows, it's sort of like, not that it's easy, but you can kind of like, there's a dynamic way to like approach a set, like play like stuff from our previous records or tell big long stories or whatever. And like when you're out with The Killers and the Black Keys, I mean, you just have to be like, we're playing the hits. Hello, Aberdeen. You know, like it's a totally different kind of exercise. And so that's kind of why we decided to do it. And it's fun. It's really fun. It's great.
And I was sort of checking out the dates coming up, and it's, yeah, I mean, you've got these enormous arenas like Manchester, mm-hmm. you know, Newcastle, and then I spotted Cambridge Junction in the middle. Like, how is it sort of switching between those? I mean, how do you adjust the sort of set?
Well, I think that, you know, that's sort of what makes it feel fresh and what keeps us on our toes, is that one night you, as Sarah said, you're playing the hits, and then the next night you're, you know, building a show that has dynamics, that takes sort of the audience on a journey. So we like to mix it up. I think if we just went out and did 3 weeks straight of like arenas, we might become a little complacent and bored on stage, you know, because it's not our show. I mean, if it was a headlining show, we would probably play differently, but yeah, no, it's good. We like to connect. We also are very well known for connecting to our audience. We really like to tell stories. We like to connect in a way that, you know, it really suits a smaller venue. So it's nice to go back and forth a little bit. Even when we headline, we really enjoy adding a lot of smaller markets to the tour, just because people respond so differently at those kinds of shows. So,
yeah. And you sort of mentioned connecting with the crowd there. I mean, your new album, it's called Heartthrob.
Yeah.
I guess that could be taken sort of two ways. I mean, you know, it could, you know, summon the image of a sort of muscle-bound hunk or something, or, you know, but I guess
there's Daniel Craig from
yeah,
Skyfall,
yeah, of
perhaps?
Course. Exactly, yeah. But I'm sure there's another level to that. What's the sort of message of the new album?
I really love being able to sort of have like a lot of different ways to explain a title. You know, like our previous records, there were things that initially inspired the title, but then as the record would evolve and we would, you know, get further into touring or get into an album cycle, it was what was really amazing was to be able to sort of like, you know, see the title like almost thematically expand, you know. And I think with Heartthrob, there was a bit of a tongue-in-cheek, like, our last record, Sainthood, was almost like the opposite. It was about like feeling self-deprecating and this sort of like rejected loser sort of pursuing the object of their affection and never really winning them over or whatever. And Heartthrob is sort of, you know, like the other side of the spectrum, you know. And I personally, what I'm really interested right now in society and with social media and with, you know, culture around music and actors and those types of things is this obsession with putting people on pedestals and having these heartthrobs that we sort of like idolize and are fascinated by. But then social media is so much about us, like independently, like me, like my life and what I think and my pictures and all of those types of things. So in some strange way, I love the idea that Heartthrob is about the people who we see as heartthrobs, and then also our desire kind of, I think, to be the heartthrob in someone's life or to be famous or whatever. So it kind of works in both both ways. And I think that Tegan's material on the record maybe fits the idea of being more of a heartthrob and a more positive sort of romantic, flirty sort of vibe. And then my songs are sort of more about still this idea of like projecting fantasies and ideas onto someone else. And I guess like fantasizing about someone like a heartthrob.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so you guys are touring around the UK right now. You'll be hitting the USA again before and then heading to Atlanta for
Christmas,
a
yeah.
lovely Christmas.
Yeah.
So yeah,
action
thanks.
Packed.
Yeah, that was a great end to the year. All right.
That was Tegan and Sarah talking to Monocle's Tom Hall. They're currently on tour in the UK before moving to the US, and their new album, Heartthrob, will be out at the start of next year. We'll hear one more track from their Midori House session at the end of the show. For the time being, you're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Time to head to New Zealand now to meet some people who are all about sound. The Audio Foundation is New Zealand's repository for all things audio, bird calls, folly effects, Maori and European oral traditions, as well as being producers and explorers of sound art and experimental audio projects. Reporter Federico Monsalve headed to the Foundation's Auckland HQ in the basement of an old Thai factory to meet with its director Zoe Drayton and hear some of her favourite sounds from their collection.
It feels a bit like you're getting into a dungeon when you walk down the stairs, doesn't it? Yeah. But actually, it's pretty light when you look at it. And we have these beautiful trees around us, and we also have a children's playground. So the soundscape that we're in all the time is generally rather lovely. Yeah, so most of the people here haven't come from an academic context so much. And I think that's where we initially began, because there was a lot of support already in academia for composers, and there was a lot of support in the music industry for perhaps more mainstream music, but there wasn't really anything in between for like a one-stop shop, as it were, that you could go for that. So initially I founded this for that reason, and it was a virtual infrastructure. So it was online, and it was a way that people could communicate through the List Digest that we had running, and we still have that. And so we tried to cover as many as possible of the voices that are within a specific era of New Zealand underground noise, essentially. And then you have the slightly more acoustic based sort of folky lo-fi underground sound like Alistair Galbraith and Pumice, and then you have what could be termed drone, but I'm sure some of the artists wouldn't want to call it that. It's in a lot of cultures to have that type of meditative trance-like state achieved through those sustained tones that shift slowly, which is, I think, the aim of many of the people who do make drone. And it's made through creating a tone with a guitar and then using the feedback to continue that tone going on, or you can use a computer to do that. And so there's a few people that work in those ways, and then there are people that use field recordings in various different ways. So Richard Francis will be one of those, and he goes and finds architectural sound, so the sounds of an elevator or a lift or air conditioning or just what you've heard right now, which is the plane going past, and he composers work that is using those sounds but putting them together in a way that's quite actually symphonic. It's not easy music.
It does require a lot of concentration and kind
It requires listening in a deep sense, and it requires a different framework of mind for it, an artistic framework of mind. It's like any form of contemporary art, I think. It's not there. I mean, obviously there will be work that's going to be easier to listen to than others, but it's not there for entertainment. And so we have an exhibition every month that changes, and we always have a screening component and an actual visual component there as well. Some people have used the stairwell. Some people have made instruments that go on and on and on and on within the gallery, and there's been a number of very different types of exhibitions that have come in here. This is Will Grierson, who lives in Berlin, and he sent us over six different field recordings of work that he'd taken in Berlin. And it's on the all of the tapes are actually looping on different mechanisms with a little mixer so that you can come in and mix it yourself and bring up the noises and bring them down and pan them and have a bit of fun with Berlin sound. Here is that we archive, not on an official or a professional level, but we digitise as much as we can of New Zealand music. So a lot of this is actually one of the New Zealand artists who's probably the most prolific artist called Witsist. And Witsist is a guy that lives up in Whangarei, and he pretty much makes music all day. And so I'd say three quarters of this archive is actually his sound, because he's just been so prolific. He's an extraordinary maker. So we'll just see what comes up.
What do you listen to after you've spent the whole day here listening to sounds? What do you go home and listen to?
Silence.
That was Zoe Drayton from New Zealand's Audio Foundation talking to Federico Monsalve. And you are listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be preparing for our close-up as we visit the Paris Photo Art Fair, amongst other things. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer is Katie Bilbao, and Holly Fisher worked her magic again. And if you like this internet malarkey, you can always drop us an electronic mail. I'm rb@monocle.com. Katie's kb@monocle.com. Send us a postcard, a recipe, a restaurant recommendation. We always want to hear from you. Time for one final song this week from their Midori House session. This is Tegan and Sarah with Call It Off. Thanks for tuning in.
I won't regret saying this thing that I'm saying. Is it better than keeping my mouth shut? That goes without saying. You call, break it off. Call, break my own heart. Maybe I would have been something you'd be good at. Maybe you would have been something I'd be good at. But now we'll never know. I'll make myself feel bad. There's a chance I start to wonder this was the thing to do. Well, I won't be out long, but I still think it better if you take your time coming over here. I think that's for best. You call. Now